Hey everybody, did you know that we've been producing Fusion Patrol for over 5 years and have nearly 250 episodes? It's a labor of love, and in that time, we have never asked for anything from you except your indulgence and your feedback. However, doing the show isn't free. There are hosting costs and costs associated with obtaining materials to discuss, but we've never been comfortable with the idea of even asking for money. There's a new player in town. You may have already heard of them on other podcasts. They're called Patreon.com. It's a crowdsourcing website geared towards online artists who produce works digitally online. Through Patreon, patrons can pledge to support works, such as our podcast, on a per-episode basis. Now, we've set up an account with Patreon, and if you'd consider supporting Fusion Patrol, please feel free to check it out. You can find it at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. That's patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd appreciate your help funding the next 5 years of Fusion Patrol. We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are looking at a new series, a much anticipated, eagerly awaited, and oft mentioned series that we were going to get around to on Fusion Patrol, and we are going to do that thing now. We are going to talk about the 1975 through 1977 TV series Space 1999. Gerry Anderson's not exactly a follow-on to UFO, but sort of kind of in a sort of non-direct tangential way. It is September 9th, 1999, and John Koenig is returning to Moonbase Alpha after a 5-year absence. Now, he is returning as the new commander of the base. His primary objective, to make sure that a manned mission to the mysterious moving planet Meta goes off without a hitch. His obstacle? A mysterious virus, which has infected the Meta probe astronauts. When he arrives, he is met by many people he knows, and a few he does not, including Victor Bergman, a longtime friend, and Dr. Helena Russell, the Moonbase's chief medical officer. The truth of the situation has been withheld from Koenig. Dr. Russell has been prevented from releasing her real findings that some mysterious terminal illness that resembles radiation sickness has infected the crew. There's just one problem with her hypothesis. There is no radiation. The moon has, for decades, been used as a nuclear waste dump, and radiation from there seems the most likely culprit, but test after test reveals nothing. Suddenly, one of the two nuclear dumps goes up in an explosion. The problem is a new effect, magnetic radiation. Now the race is on. The second nuclear dump is much larger than the first, and if it explodes, the consequences will be fatal. The Alphans attempt to break up the nuclear pile by dispersing the waste over a larger area of the moon, but the magnetic radiation buildup is happening too fast. The waste dump explodes, but instead of killing the moon, the explosion acts like a giant rocket motor, hurling the moon out of Earth's orbit and into space. With considerable damage to the base, no clear information concerning the speed and course the moon is taking, and the distance back to Earth, Koenig decides that they should stay aboard Alpha and the moon in an attempt to survive. As they leave the solar system, they hear the mysterious signal from the planet Meta. Perhaps they can find a home there. So, wow, Space 1999. This was, I don't know about you, but this was the right time for me. I had grown up on Star Trek day in and day out and day in and day out, and so Star Trek was a piece of the fabric of my life. But Space 1999, when it came along, was really like the first Pretender in the build-up to it. It's like, wow, this is going to be awesome. I'm so looking forward to this. And it felt like this was going to be new and fresh and exciting, whereas Star Trek, although part of life was always the same because there was no new Trek, essentially, for my entire conscious life. So this is really the first show I ever felt the hype for.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about 11, so it was the perfect age, too. I mean, I just really was in that frame of mind. So I think when I watched Space 1999 through, I may have been a little inclined to think it was awesome, whether it was or not.
So you were approaching Space 1999 the same way I was approaching Star Lost initially.
Could be, because Star Lost I never really... If I ever saw it, I totally didn't know I had seen it. Disappeared off the radar if I ever... But I certainly did not, you know, get the build-up or for that. So, yeah, mm-hmm. Space 1999 was what I thought was going to be the heir presumptive to Star Trek in my existence. Let's talk about this particular episode and a little bit about... the background here before we go into it. Apparently, and I'm sure we mentioned this on the UFO podcast, at some point, Gerry Anderson was in production to make a second season of UFO. And because the ratings had started off really strong and then tanked in the United States for UFO, and then the executives had their suggestions like, you know, less stories on Earth in the Midlands and more stories on the moon base. And when they pulled the rug out from under him, they basically, he said, you know, if you give me another year, I'll blow up the Earth and everything will be set on the moon. And it evolved into Space 1999, and he didn't blow up the Earth, which is good for us since here we are living in the post-moon departure world.
Mm-hmm.
But he did launch into space so that there would be no chance of them doing tea in the Midlands.
Right, sort of lost in space on the moon.
Yes, yes. And quite rightly so. And we'll probably talk a little bit about that fundamental difference from Space 1999 and Star Trek. But so what did you think of Breakaway? Can you remember when you first saw it? And,
oh,
and
yes.
How does it fit with your... viewing now?
Well, I would say that this did more than hold up. It exceeded what I remembered watching.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. I saw it when I was 13 or 14, and thinking that it was, to that point, the smartest science fiction I'd ever seen, and I still hold by that. At that time, I still say it was the smartest science fiction, and I would even, at least in terms of Breakaway goes...
Okay.
Now, you know, like we did with Fantastic Journey, I'm not going to jump the timeline and start thinking about the future. But just looking at Breakaway alone, I thought that was one of the most well-slicked, produced hours of television that I had seen in an incredibly long time. And then to watch it again just a few days ago, I was not only... remembering things as I was watching it, I was seeing things that I didn't remember,
mm-hmm.
which made the viewing experience just that much more enjoyable. And I don't know about you, but I was watching it in high definition,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, yeah, some shows when they're remastered for high def don't hold up. Because the production values were such for those shows. I mean, no one thought, oh, this is going to be on television. You know, it's who's going to really care? I mean, you know, they were thinking television for that day. It's you know, people have got small sets. Most people might have black and white. I mean, who's going to care? I mean, we can really cut corners on the budget, and it'll be fine.
No, this show is stunning.
And I didn't get that. Watching this. I mean, even when we watched UFO. In high definition, there were scenes in shadow that I thought looked very poor when remastered for high definition. This did not. I was amazed at how polished it looked.
This program, when it was made, is all high quality film. It's the production values of the moon base and the special effects. I mean, it's gorgeous. It was gorgeous at the time.
I think it's even more beautiful now.
I have the remastered DVDs, and they look fantastic.
I've got the remastered DVDs as well. They look pretty good. But what I saw the other night.
Well, where were you watching it in HD? Where were you watching it in HD? If you have the DVDs,
Hulu Plus.
Hulu. Okay. It is one of the prettiest shows. Even when they get around into space, it's not just dull black and white and stars. It's very colorful. I can't say that I've seen anything like it until Babylon 5,
mm-hmm.
when they tried to do the same thing with kind of the nebula in the background.
Which would give off, you know, unusual color palettes in space.
Right.
Yes, this looked absolutely just breathtakingly beautiful. Even though the first season, there's a lot of white and slightly off-white as part of the main color scheme, but it's okay. Because there are some other nice coloring accentuations that you see in uniform and you see in set design and props, mm-hmm. that just give it a lot of sparkle.
Isn't though, and this is not a criticism of it. I mean, I think the moon base is just the interior corridors and the design, and perhaps some of it is not the most. At least the doors are square. Nothing I hate worse than a science fiction show when the doors are just some weird shape and you're just like, why would you make a door triangular with a left side bump out or something? But
right.
Here the base it's functional, it's clean, it looks like it's probably built out of modular components.
Mm-hmm. Which would make sense if they were building a moon base. You know, and I've had this little apocryphal theory that just to kind of, you know, for my own personal enjoyment, that Space 1999 is a sequel to UFO. That the moon base
is headcanon out there that Alpha is built on top of
Shadowhead. Yeah, that's kind of been my little pet theory as well. There's no evidence to say one way or the other.
Actually, I think there was an article in Starlog. I won't swear it was Starlog, but somewhere in something like that where they put together a timeline between the UFO and Space 1999 universe, and they did tie those two together. In other words, somewhere about 1986, 87, the aliens just stopped coming. And then we had the World War III that Koenig will mention at some point in the future, and then, as they got back together, then they took the shadow base and they built out the moon base Alpha for the space exploration. So, yeah, there have been people that have tried to tie those two together. But so far as I know, Gerry Anderson has never.
Well, you know, like I said, it's something that I've just kind of played with for my own personal entertainment. There's nothing there to indicate strongly that is the situation. In any case, the idea of building the base, because as you said, everything looks very modular. I mean, that is how they would build. I mean, that's how they build the ISS station.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's all done in modules. So for them to be building Moonbase Alpha in a modular fashion makes perfect scientific sense.
Makes perfect set dressing sense because they can
absolutely
reuse it. But the thing, what I was going to get to, that is not a disparagement, but it's kind of funny, is it so looks 1970s. And I don't know what it is, whether it's the shape of the round corners or the, but it just or the lamps on the mission,
Yeah, but we had the same problem when we had UFO. I mean, here they were trying to project what 1980 would look like, and they were doing it with 1960s sensibility. They're trying to extrapolate. Yeah. So, and we just got the same thing again here, and I think that's sort of. At times, a very difficult thing for science fiction to do. I mean, obviously, there are other other shows and movies that have been successful in, I wouldn't say in predicting, but at least in creating something that doesn't look like it was extrapolated from some years distant past.
But my, I guess part of it is because it doesn't look like a house in the 70s. It doesn't look like there. Yes, you can take the computer and have the tape. A piece of tape coming out, and you go, ha ha, well, they missed that. I'm not talking about that. There is something in the design sensibility, whereas Shadow Headquarters was very, It could have been 50s. It could have been 60s. Now, the moon base is a little bit different, but, you know, just cement walls and doors and things. Whereas there is just something to the type plastic, the type color palette. I don't know what it is. Or perhaps we are redefining it after the fact, because if you saw walls that looked even remotely like that, you would go 1970s space station or moon base.
And yes.
Yeah. It is the definitive expression of 1970s space design.
Yeah, and it's not. You're right. It's not a disparaging. It's not a criticism. In fact, if anything, I'm going to tip my hat at least the production crew for having some attempt at foresight to say, this is what the future is going to be. This is what we think the future is going to be. I mean, a lot of studios and companies have tried to create predictions. I mean, even Disneyland did that with their and they don't have it anymore, the Monsanto House of the Future, which looks like it would have fit right into Space 1999 with its curved corners and walls and rounded corners in the walls, things like that. I mean, they had this idea what 1980 would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, at some point, they had to just completely, you know, bulldoze the thing, because it as
1980
times
came and went.
Well, but I mean, they got rid of it long before 1980. But even as they started to climb, you know, well into the 60s, it became quite apparent that we're not going down that path that we originally thought we were going to be going down in the late 1950s. I mean, we had this idea, this is what the future is going to be, and already we're diverging from that path. So we're seeing the same thing here in Space 1999. They had this idea that plastic was going to be it, and maybe there was probably some very sound thinking as to why they predicted that kind of architecture and construction manner would be the wave of the future. I could see how they would think that.
Petroleum,
I mean, obviously,
is cheap and plentiful.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, it didn't go in that direction, but I could see why they thought it would, and therefore took that idea and ran with it. Does it give it a really weird, dated look today? Yes. Is it a fault of the show?
No.
I'm gonna say no. I'm going to say that at least, you know, again, the set design and the production design, at least they took a seriously hard look at what they thought would be the future. And yeah, they were wrong, but I will give them credit for at least trying to create something that they thought would be the future.
Not only is it still beautiful, but you can also tell that it was not designed to be military.
Mm-mm. No, very scientific.
Well, it's not just that. It's designed to be attractive. So, like Koenig's office, where he's got this big, spacious workspace desk and office and conference room, and it opens out onto the mission bay. That's not functional. That's aesthetic.
It's aesthetics. It's purely. Yeah, I mean, it looks great. I mean, I could see there being something functional about it. I mean, he's working. He needs.
Oh, yeah.
His little command area, so the entire wall opens up, you know, and when that finally happens, that's a really great moment when you finally see it, because for the, you know, the first several times he goes in and out of his office, he's simply opening up one panel, and it's like, it's just a door. Okay, fine. He's got a door that goes from his office into main mission. You know, it's like his ready room. Okay, great, sure. But when that entire wall opens up, you can't help but go, whoa, yes. Most of that whoa comes from the fact that it's visually stunning.
It's kind of amusing, though, in that line. He's like, I'll be right with you.
And then the wall
just opens.
Basically,
I'm just sitting right next to him across the wall, and it's open up.
Yeah.
So,
but you know, let's say that there is a certain functionality to it. I mean, I could see that. I mean, this allows him the opportunity to, you know, play a commander in terms of the administrative aspect of the office. I mean, I'm sure this is why it was originally designed. He could be working at his office, and if there's something that's very important going on, let's say, you know, within main mission or even out on the moon, on the lunar surface that they're monitoring on the screen, it allows him the opportunity to be able to kind of do both things, mm-hmm. you know, see what's going on. I mean, and at the same time work in his office. So I could see there being a functionality to it, but I like how in this particular episode it was played purely for a dramatic effect, and it was very effective.
Of course, they've got all the windows on main missions. So they're looking out on the moon. They've got observation galleries. It's all it just doesn't come off as a military base. It comes off as a scientific, and it comes off maybe even as a
very
bit
livable
of a prestige assignment. You know that you're at our cool command base on the moon.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, it's a plum assignment. Absolutely. I don't get any, I don't doubt that for the slightest, for 1 minute. I would say that it's a real feather in the cap of whichever country or conglomeration of countries is responsible for putting Moonbase Alpha there in the first place.
Mm. So, Let's just carry on one other thing before we talk about the main spot, and that is one of the things I thought was very interesting in this story, and I'm not going to call it, it's not spoilery per se, because it isn't, but much like UFO, there is that Gary Anderson touch in this. The politicians on Earth are keeping the virus or the radiation sickness a secret because there's a budget hearing next week, and if word of this gets out, they're not going to get their appropriations. And there's a very understated and not even we're never going to be satisfied about Commander Gorski leaving the base. I mean, clearly there's something going on. Clearly Koenig and Gorski don't like each other. And Gorski's being removed for some reason. It's obviously politics, but we don't see it. And we have a lot of that in UFO, where they had that sort of, this is a political situation that's going on. And it feels kind of like it's pervasive to this show, like it is UFO. But once they lose contact with Earth, it doesn't work that
way.
Well,
no, really, the politicians are out of the picture for the most part.
Right. And the other thing that I just want to say, this story that I think is one of the better things that's been done in terms of pilots. I'm sure I just talked about this the other day on Pilotitis, that, you know, you got to have the setup and you got to have a story. But in this one, the setup was the story. We go from Koenig arriving on the base and exploring the mystery.
Oh, we jump right into the plot complication.
And it feels like you've got this show that's, you know, whole and complete. It's a complete mystery. They're battling to save the day, and in any other show they would have saved the day, except in this one that blows up in their face, and that starts the next phase of the adventure. So the actual setup for the show was a complete whole story that maintained an hour and did very well, and I applaud them from doing that.
It was very well executed. The pacing of the narrative was flawless, in my opinion. There were moments that they knew exactly when to ratchet up the tension and then to back it off a little bit again. I mean, even though I had seen Breakaway twice prior, I mean, I saw it once when it was on or syndicated to the United States back in 75, and then I saw it again on the remastered DVD. So this was my third viewing, and oddly enough, I found myself more emotionally invested this time. Maybe it's because I was watching it for our podcast. But I found that as the complication or the threat that was being manifested by the magnetic radiation, first in Area 1 and then in Area 2, as that really started to take hold, I really got pulled in to the emotional content of this particular episode, and when things started really blowing up, I mean,
No pun intended.
I mean, to me, that's a credit to two things. That's a credit to again, the visual production is so amazingly beautiful that it never yanks me out of the story, which would have been tragic because B, the story is amazing. It is so well crafted and so well balanced. This is one of those episodes that I call economical, where nothing is wasted. Even though we are thrown into what appears to be the middle of a situation with our introduction into Dr. Russell and with Bergman as well as John Koenig and everybody else. I mean, a lot of people, Amubay Safa, they already know each other. So we are having to play catch up, which in some circumstances could be really bad. But this time it works out really well in that they were able to develop these characters at such a really well done pace.
It's very, we'll use economical, but it's very economical that they can bring John Koenig in and I've been away from the moon for 5 years, and so therefore I know Bergman and Paul and Alan Carter.
Right,
and
so
they don't have to do an introduction to everybody, but then
right.
he needs to meet Dr. Russell, so he gets the opportunity to meet her. So you also get their introductory. That's very well done that way.
But that yeah, and that was deliberate, obviously, because you know, and I know that I said I wasn't going to jump the timelines, but I'm going to jump the timeline right here, and that is anybody who's seen the series knows that. John and Helen become a couple, you know, which is totally understandable given
since
that at the time Barbara Bain and Martin Landau were married. So it makes perfect sense that they would actually pair them up in terms of their characters for the show. So as far as this episode goes, I have no qualms. In fact, I think it was a great idea that Helen is the newbie as far as John goes, because we're kind of walking along John's we're walking most of the time. We're walking alongside John Koenig. As things are going on here, we take for granted that yes, he knows Victor and he knows Paul, he knows Alan, he knows all these other people. So that's great. We don't have to worry about any background introductions there, as you just pointed out. Helen, the way they introduced her, I thought was incredibly smart. I'm going to jump to the one really interesting scene in this episode. And this is smart writing. Koenig does something enormously reckless.
Yes.
And that's when he grabs an eagle and he's going to fly over Area 1. He's going to do a low pass over Area 1. And I can't tell you the number of times we've watched a show, be it UFO, Blake 7, Doctor Who, doesn't matter. And we find ourselves screaming at the television, "You idiot, why are you doing that?" And then finally, we get Helen, who calls him out on that. And it did two. It served really great two purposes. One, it shows that, Helen, you're on the side of the audience, because we're going to assume that the audience is going to be saying, "Koenig, you're an idiot. Don't do it." So Helen becomes our advocate in the show in terms of that particular aspect. And then the second thing is, of course, it allows us to kind of get further introduction into her character a little bit. At the same time, we get to see more of what emotionally drives her. So I thought her scenes, as far as the way they were written in this episode, were incredibly smart.
Yeah, it's funny that that's two things that pop up and that remind me of Babylon 5, because obviously Babylon 5 is much newer than this. And that's, I think we have sequences towards the beginning of the series where Sinclair is doing incredibly reckless things. And
he gets called out on it.
Calls him on it.
Yep.
It's like, "Hey, you know something? You're doing stupid stuff there, guy.
You're being reckless, buddy." Exactly.
Which is very, as you say, is very rare for a TV show at the time. This is another thing that Koenig does when he introduces himself to Dr. Russell. He walks in the room. He's never met her before. And he looks around the room, focuses on that replica microscope that she's got.
And starts playing with it.
Runs over and goes, "Hey, this is a Mark 47 Luigi Watson with like Louis Pasteur had." So he's introducing himself to a new person. He's trying to make a connection.
Yeah.
Which, you know, fine. You look around the room immediately and try to come up with something that works. And also, that's probably not John Koenig's field of expertise.
No, I wouldn't think so.
So it shows what sort of the nerdy guy there is there, too. The science-y, nerdy guy that he is. That's something, the kind of thing he can latch on. And that he's in a multifaceted in his nature.
And again, no, go ahead.
And then, you know, Dr. Russell is, just a replica. I want it as a prize. That gives us something about her, too.
She's not just a
doctor. She's a prize-winning doctor.
And it's, again, this is a very brilliantly written scene in just a few moments, we get more of a better, get a better look at both characters in what is just really small talk, and yet we come to understand them a little bit better. They're better fleshed out, and it's not too long, it's not too short. It fits the narrative just right so that you can then jump back to your main plot and, you know, the main threat of this particular story. So again, this is really beautiful economic writing where you are able to develop your characters and propel your storyline, but not have one do so at the expense of the other. Therefore, nothing gets wasted in terms of moving the episode forward.
Well, this story was written by George Bellak, who I'd never heard of before. And unfortunately, I don't think he writes any more episodes of Space 1999. He was a writer going back into the 50s in the United States. So he's a U.S. writer and is an Emmy-nominated writer for some of his work on CBS Playhouse back in the whenever the CBS Playhouse was, probably in the 50s. So he also wrote the basically the writer's guide for Space 1999. So he is very influential in the setup and in the nature, but then he did not write any more stories and left the show fairly shortly after this. So just put that out there. So we will not be seeing Mr. Economically Emmy Award nominating.
Well, that's
writer.
A shame. That's a shame. But it will be interesting to see how the future episodes, especially for this first season, how they stack up in comparison to this one.
Yeah, and there is no... there is no science fiction on his list here, except for this one episode of Space 1999.
This was his only science fiction?
As far as I can see from Wikipedia. Yep.
I'm highly impressed. For someone who has never written science fiction before, this is, you know, I'm giving away, well, I think by now anybody who's listening to us is kind of getting the idea of what we generally think overall of this episode. So I'm just going to go out and say it. I think what he's crafted here was something that was nothing short of brilliant.
I certainly, when it was over, I can remember being hyped for next week.
I was too.
So, I mean, that was you know, me and the kids and everybody else at school. This was...
yeah, we all talked about
it. Space 1999 times, so...
When I got together with my best friend and one of his friends, and we just chatted up this episode, and we were just really fascinated by...
That's because you were old.
Everything about...
We were playing Space 1999 because we were little kids. At 13, I stopped doing those things, but at 11, we were still running around making laser pistols and stuff and shooting.
Well, considering that I was doing cosplay all the way into my 20s, I'm going to ignore what you just said.
So, anyway, it was good, and it. Well, there are a couple spots in the story where I kind of feel like, I don't know. There are a couple places where, like, when I can't remember which astronaut it was, but the one that was going, "I gotta get out of here, Commander." I feel like Koenig and Bergman took a little too long to realize that he sounded maniacally crazy. Over there.
Would that... Sparkman?
No,
sure.
Sparkman was one of the astronauts. Collins.
Was it Collins? Oh, yes, yes, it was Collins.
Was trying to bust the window out with the thing. I mean, they were obviously intent on the check going on. And but, you know, it's like, "I gotta get out of here, Commander." "All right, Collins, don't worry. We'll be leaving soon." It's like...
Yeah, but they weren't really... Yeah, that's...
It's like,
"What,
are you gotta go take a leak, Collins? What's the hurry here? Why would you, in the chain of command... Why would one of your subordinates be telling the commander, "We got to get out of here"?
Yeah, like that would have been a red flag.
He should have turned around and looked right at that moment, but he waited until he started screaming, and then it's like, ah, well, he's going for the window now with his helmet. So, I also found that the illness didn't, I don't know, you know, the whole thing with the eye turning all milky white, and it was visually cool, but... I don't know that it made a whole heck of a lot of sense in the scheme of things.
No, I agree. There's, unless it's got something to do with the mass or that irradiated mass that's that we see in the I don't know if it's an X-ray or an MRI that Helen was
space
looking at.
Space RI.
Yeah. Because you can clearly see this really ugly red blotch that, based on the positioning, would be
kind of
it looked like
eye.
It was kind of close to that one eye, because it seemed to be the right eye of everybody who was ever affected. So apparently there was some attempt to at least try to imply how that might have happened, at least, you know, as far as the eye goes. But you're right, in terms of the one scene with Collins completely beginning to freak out, that doesn't speak kind of well of either Bergman or Koenig.
Yeah, they're just totally ignoring him.
They're completely blowing him off. I mean, okay, sure, I can understand that they're completely fascinated and wrapped up in this situation and this investigation that they're in. But yeah, with Collins all of a sudden just blurting out, "I really need to get out of here," man, that's a red alert right there. Anybody with any kind of awareness should have caught that and turned around and tried to see what's going on, you know, because that's it's not necessarily insubordination in the way that he said it, but it's certainly not respective of command authority the way you just kind of blurt that out like that.
Exactly. Let's see, what else we got here?
Well, there's the...
We've got the whole meta-probe thing, which...
Yeah, that was the thing I was about to bring up.
Doesn't go anywhere, yeah.
Well, this kind of ties into the whole politician thing as well. And we hear that early on as we meet Commissioner Simmons, played by a very scarily young Roy Dotrice. It's like, wow, I didn't even realize it was supposed to be him. In fact, I'm so used to seeing him old that to see him young with that mop of hair was almost laughable. But it might have been his. Who knows?
I have to say, I don't know what Roy Dotrice has been in apart from
this. Well, he later is known for two. Actually, he's really known for one thing later on among just general television viewing fans, and that was the CBS series Beauty and the Beast. But I remember him also appearing in Babylon 5.
Oh, yes, I remember he was in Babylon 5.
Yeah, towards the end of season 2.
That's three. Three Babylon 5 references in one episode.
Imagine that.
Huh.
Yeah. So I'm familiar with him at that age. To see him this young was a little unusual. Nonetheless, we've got this commissioner, and whichever political group he's representing, and I assume he is.
Lunar
Commission, yeah. They're hell-bent. Oh, I'm sorry, there's my Doctor Who reference. On getting this probe to Meta. That is number one, top priority. Nothing can interfere with it.
All right, let's play with that just a little bit. I can understand that. If what the premise we're told is that Meta is somehow passing through our range for a very short period of time, and there are signals coming from it, which imply intelligent life, so, you know, it's an all-out effort to get it done on schedule, on time.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I get that. I appreciate that.
They will have spent billions and billions of dollars to achieve that, and if it goes pairs up, then there's a serious problem there. So I can understand the pressure, political and otherwise, to get it done. Now, here's the question. When Koenig goes up to the moon base to solve the problem with the virus, and they haven't told him that it isn't a virus, is it because the Commissioner Simmons is totally aware of what's going on and is holding it back from him? And why does he hold it back from him until he gets to the moon?
Hmm.
And then he isn't the one who tells him anyway. I mean, for crying out loud, you can't just say, hey, well, you know, I didn't know. Or is it because Gorski is not releasing the information that Dr. Russell wants to report?
That's it. that's what I got.
Koenig accuses
Helen of not telling anybody.
Well, yes.
Koenig
complains to Simmons and says, you know, these people of radiation or something. And, oh, yes, I'm familiar with Dr. Russell's theory. So he did.
He heard something.
He heard something. Did Gorski pass it on? Did Gorski pass the whole thing on? We never find that out in this story.
No.
Is that where is that lawsuit come in? But if Simmons knows,
if he knew everything,
why
then,
wouldn't he have told Koenig?
Yeah, which is why I don't think he did know everything. I think he was partially in the dark, so to speak. Helen was able to, through whatever means, maybe initially Gorski did present some of Helen's findings. Maybe he kind of watered them down, or you know, to make it look more palatable, because it's very possible that he was feeling the pressure as well to get the probe.
Oh, I'm sure he was.
I don't doubt that he was. And that's why he wasn't necessarily reporting back everything that Helen was discovering.
Do we think he was replaced because the probe wasn't making enough progress? And it's just like, you know something? Let's just get somebody in there who can. And send up Koenig, you know.
We really don't get a definitive answer on that, and we're not going to now. But I would dare say that a theory would be that astronauts are still getting sick, and that Gorski clearly is failing in that one particular area in helping Helen to find a cure. Therefore, because META is such a very important project, let's replace him with a no-nonsense guide that's going to find that will provide all avenues necessary to get that cure and keep the META probe on track.
Here's another interesting choice in the way the episode played out. Koenig arrives on the moon base, and Gorski is there to greet him. And he says, well, you must be very tired from your trip, so when you're rested up, I'll if you want to talk before I go, I'll be in my quarters. And off he goes. We never see Gorski again.
Mm-mm.
And
for all we know, he left.
Well, we know he left. I mean, he said he was leaving, but you know, he'll be here for a few more hours if you want to see me. The question is, did Koenig ever go to talk to him? Or did Koenig just ignore him? Because I get the feeling Koenig just ignored him.
It's possible. I kind of get the feeling that Koenig just got caught up in things that were going on. I mean, first with the astronauts that were dying. Then there was the situation with Collins, the discovery of the magnetic radiation. I think things just began to kind of run away from him. I'd like to believe that maybe at some point he had every intention, but I would also say that it was very low on his list of priorities, and that everything else was much more important for him to take care of at the time. He would have done it. I don't think he was blowing him off entirely. I mean, this is just supposition. I mean, we have no evidence one way or the other. I just kind of like to think that Koenig would have talked to him had events played out differently.
I feel
but
like Koenig didn't like him.
That's really unusual. I didn't get any feeling on that one way or the other. At first I thought Koenig didn't like him.
Well, there's that whole bit about Gorski being a survivor, and oh yes, he's very flexible, and it's just kind of the way he said it, like he's trying to say something.
He's being diplomatic about...
He's being diplomatic about the fact that the guy is one of those people that does whatever he has to do to stay in favor.
Yeah.
Is the impression I got out of it. And
yeah,
so,
he's the Teflon commander. You know, nothing sticks. It's very possible, but I also kind of got the feeling that towards the end of their little tete-a-tete, that it didn't necessarily feel entirely hostile or even adversarial. It felt maybe a little awkward.
Oh, well, it would be, wouldn't it?
But that's
you're the guy that's taken my job.
Oh, yeah, you're taking my... Yeah, you're the guy who's fired me. Because there's that weird line, you know, that I think it's Koenig has. Oh, you know, he always lands on his feet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's definitely casting certain aspersions.
Yeah, there's a hint there that Koenig knows something about Gorski's survival rate.
You know, that we're given this whole world that's obviously filled with politics and budgets and political wrangling and it's totally not used. You know,
well, not anymore.
Episode.
I mean, and that's a fascinating thing about that, because so long as the moon is in orbit around the Earth, they are subject to Earth jurisdiction and politics. The moment it's blown out of the Earth's orbit, hey, guess what, you politicians? Yeah, hasta la vista, baby. We're not dealing with you anymore. So, yeah, that is kind of a fascinating little...
But it's not just politicians. I mean, you know, a person who's an always lands on your feet kind of guy, that's just a personality type that doesn't necessarily get along with other people or does or doesn't. So, you know, different...
Yeah, because he's not the kind of person who is willing to get the job done. He'll only get done what's necessary so that he can continue to live to see another day.
Yeah. It's also interesting that when, you know, Koenig is... They're making a big point here of, you know, yes, I've been sent here to get the Metaprobe going, but I hope you realize I'm not the type of person who's going to ignore the fact that people are dying. So he's throwing over his political marching orders to do the right thing.
Right.
And he really kind of has no choice there with regards to the astronauts, because as Dr. Russell says, you know, the backup astronauts are fine, but they've done everything that the other astronauts did, and they were fine up until the moment that they weren't. And so, you know, who knows what's going to happen? I don't know what's going on here. Those guys could pop 2 months into the mission. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that puts sort of unacceptable risk on Koenig. So would he have gone ahead with it or not? It's kind of interesting to see what they were trying to do with Koenig's personality, juggling this sort of conflicting priorities.
Mm-hmm.
But when the safety of the base comes in, then, you know, we're all, I don't care. And it's interesting that he sent an emergency code and then refused to talk to Simmons, forcing Simmons to come to the moon.
No, because that's the only way Simmons could face the truth.
That's a good question. Did he do it so Simmons could, so that he could talk to him first to face, or was it because he wanted to put Simmons in the same dangerous situation that the rest of them were so that he would have no choice but to go along?
Yes.
That's kind of rotten. I mean, yes, he's a politician, and sure, why not?
It's a very shrewd move.
Die, but
it's a highly shrewd move on Koenig's part. But that is, I mean, that's the best way to get Simmons to be able to understand what it is that everybody on Alpha is dealing with by being in the presence of that danger as well, by being subjected to that threat. It's the only way that I'm simply extrapolating based on what we see. I'm getting the feeling that Koenig took a very shrewd move and put Simmons in that same position as the rest of them were, because that's the only way that he was going to get him to realize this is what we're dealing with and we need to really rethink our priorities here and better focus on saving lives, preventing the moon from blowing up, as opposed to getting a rocket or getting a probe over to Meta. Yes, that's important too, but, you know, what's the point if the moon goes kablooey?
Because then it would crack the egg. And then
the beast would come out and then lay a new moon.
Good point.
Yeah.
If only they had known that, then this would not have been they wouldn't have been so worried. That is still just the most absurd thing ever. And here we are talking about a program where the moon gets blasted out of Earth's orbit and travels through space. And we can still point to even more absurd moon-based science fiction that we are aware of. Let's see. So they're on their mission into space. Koenig makes the call because the computer won't do it for him. We're going to stay behind. Do you think that this will result in problems in the future? Because that is the sort of executive decision you have to make. And presumably there are 311 men and women on Moonbase Alpha. Perhaps some of them did not necessarily agree that staying was the best course of action.
Well, I have every reason to believe that, yeah, that's going to create a problem at some point down the road in some fashion or another. It's very possible that...
Because we could still have more of this whole political thing with factions of people who are like, you know, I think we shouldn't have, you know, necessarily done that. But it's been long enough for me, I don't remember all of the details.
And I think that there's also going to be a bit of a social aspect to it. as well, because you're going to have all these people. We have no real idea as to how big Alpha is in relation to the number of people who are living in it.
Well, that's a good point. We know it's 311 because they mentioned that at some point, but...
I mean, it looks like it's fairly good size, but I'm just wondering, what's the possibility of people getting forms of cabin fever, shall we say?
I would assume that these people have at least been screened for being capable of staying up on the moon for extended periods of time.
Yeah, but this is something new, because now you've added this new dynamic into their lives, and that is, I could be up here for an extended period of time, but that was with the understanding that I was going to be going home after so many months, or maybe after even a year. Now I got to rethink that, because now they're thinking, I could be here till the day I die.
Which could be tomorrow.
It could be tomorrow. It could be next year. It could be 10 years from now. But I'm going to be on this moon base. And that kind of thinking, especially if done by enough people, could sort of create feelings of unrest among the general population, I would think. I believe it does, but I can't remember for certain.
We have a different dynamic here than Star Trek, where on Star Trek you've all signed up and you're out there in deep space. You're essentially volunteers, and you're part of the chain of command, and there are crew rotations, and you can get off without necessarily just being killed by aliens.
And there's also the chance of getting home, too.
Yeah, that's a very different approach. And you're out actively doing something. Here in Space 1999, one of the fundamental key differences is that they are at the mercy of fate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to, I think, produce a different climate and attitude.
Yeah, their mission now is simply to survive. I mean, they will explore in the process, but their mission is to A, survive, and B, if at all possible, get home.
Exactly.
Or C, if at all possible, find a new home. So that's a completely different kind of situation than what we were seeing in any of the iterations of Star Trek, where you're right, they signed up, they're part of an organization. I mean, the closest one that you've got is Voyager. That's the closest parallel to what Space 1999 even had. But even then, they were operating by the rule book with this. I mean, they knew which direction to head home. You know, Voyager, they knew it was going to take them God knows how many years before they finally got there. And in the process, they were going to be adhering to the rules of Starfleet. They're going to be doing exploration, you know, because, hey, you know, we're in a whole new region of space we've never been able to explore before. So
think of the back pay.
Yeah, exactly. But in the case of Space 1999, I don't think that any of them really signed up. They are not explorers per se.
No, but they're all certainly,
I don't take them for that.
They're all probably all scientists, so,
yeah,
or astronauts.
I mean, Alan's an astronaut. I mean, you got Paul, who I don't know what his skill is, or Sandra. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what Sandra's skill is either, to be honest. But yeah, they're all scientists, technicians. Yeah, scientists, technicians, pilots. But they're not explorers like you got on Star Trek. So already there's a different dynamic, as you pointed out. So for them to now be faced with the situation of, ooh, I'm trapped here. I have no chance of going home. I think tomorrow will be the day I go mad. Yeah, that's what we're facing now.
Okay. So just sort of on that point, but we had one of our listeners, I think, drop us an email, if I recall correctly, when they heard that we were going on to Space 1999. And they pointed me at a couple of resources where people have gone through every episode of Space 1999 and counted the people who died, because we have a finite number of people on Moonbase Alpha. There are no crew replacements. There are
right.
And we're not gonna go there, because we don't need to go there, because there are websites that if you really wanted to go out there, you could find out how many people died in each episode of Space 1999. But what he suggested, and I think I'll try to keep track of this, and we haven't even mentioned them, but we're going to, is how many eagles do they blow up?
Oh, man.
During the course of this series. Now,
and they don't necessarily have the resources to make new eagles.
No, and it is one of the coolest spaceships, totally impractical in Earth orbit. But it is a cool-looking spaceship. It looks functional. It looks versatile. You know, the ability to change out the inner section of the craft for different functions.
That's so Thunderbirds.
Well, it is. It is. Although this is Brian Johnson doing the special effects on this, and he's doing a bang-up job on the model work and whatnot. I counted, let's see here, 2, 4 eagles, maybe 5. In this episode, if we're counting the one that was out there at the meta station, because as the probe spins off along with the space station, there's an eagle spinning away to its destruction. So we'll count that one. Koenig definitely wrecked one. There was another one that was wrecked, and the remote control one.
That's 4.
Went as well. Yeah, there were 4 there, and there was another one that was kind of maybe. It was having problems at the there was an explosion when the waste dump started to go up, and then there was another explosion sort of near an eagle, but it wasn't exactly at the eagle, and I couldn't tell whether that was supposed to be. So I'm going to count it as a blow up, but so 5 for this episode. I don't think they killed that many people. I have a sneaky suspicion we're going to lose a lot more eagles than we do people.
Probably
on this series. So. Our semi-official count for episode Breakaway, 5 eagles destroyed. I don't have anything else on this episode.
I don't either. Oh, one thing that I did not remember seeing the first 2 times, oddly enough, I do not remember this at all, but was happy to see it on this latest viewing, was the news report from Earth after the moon was blown out of Earth's orbit. And the reporting on the conditions was really nice because I can understand when you're writing the story, naturally you're going to focus all your attention on what's happening on the moon. Yes, I get that because that's where our characters are. But it was a nice little touch to show this is what the Earth is now undergoing as a result of the moon being ripped from its orbit. So again, a nice little touch for accuracy's sake, I suppose.
We're going to have to put that as sort of a nod towards accuracy because I've seen enough over the years. Obviously, there's been plenty of time for people who know orbital physics and just plain physics to put, of course, the whole notion here is completely and utterly absurd that the nuclear explosions could push it out of orbit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what we do know is that if we didn't have the moon, the moon and the Earth as a system act almost like a gyroscope.
Uh-huh.
Without it, the Earth will not maintain a steady positioning. So it's likely to swing. It's screwed. It'll probably shift because you've got a mass issue there with regards to its orbit of the sun, because the Earth moon is a system, and Earth is absolutely done for in this situation. The moon should be done for, but
thought that it would be done for. I mean, but naturally you can't do that there because you have no show.
Right. Yep. No. I completely get it. It's just but it is interesting that they did at least mention volcanoes and earthquakes and whatnot. Now, one thing I do want to mention, there is they get a really good shot of the hero prop. One of the things that they have in Space 1999 is a little comm link, which is they wear them on their belt and they open the doors and they have a little video television communicator.
It's a universal remote
that they can talk to through people on the little tiny black and white screen, which is just cool.
I thought it was really cool when I saw it back in the 70s. I mean,
it's actually bigger than you think, and then they shoot it with the comlink looking at the so you get the little
But the concept was fascinating, and I kept thinking, man, that's some really amazing technology. And now today, I'm kind of
what I liked sure. was there were a couple of times on this episode where Koenig would call somebody and he'd be looking at a blank screen and the person would have to walk into the screen to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'd be on the screen talking, and then when he'd talk to them, they'd have to look up and go, "Oh, hi, Commander."
And
I know that that is never going to happen again in this series. It's
no,
just going to be turned on, and the face is going to be there.
There was one thing that I thought was peculiar.
Is it the woman?
No.
Okay.
Well, yeah, she was. That was kind of weird how she was always there.
Not only was she always there. I mean, she was always there talking like she was the Moonbase Alpha news channel. But
yeah.
After the disaster,
oh yeah,
she's lying there on the floor in front of the camera,
yeah,
still. And you're like, and you know, nursing a wound or something. You're like, really? You just have to keep broadcasting, huh?
Yeah. No, the one that I kept thinking about is when Koenig is talking to Simmons and when he's still on Earth, and Koenig is literally walking around the pylon where the screens are at, and at one point he's like off to the side talking to it at this really bizarre angle that there's no way Simmons could have been able to see him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a strange scene. I mean, it's got – if you don't look at it from a scientific or a technical aspect, it's got some nice drama to it. But the way Martin Landau was walking around is like more the way you walk around a person who's physically there. Simmons, but he's treating the pylon as if that's Simmons himself. It was a very strange scene. Didn't take me out. Well, I guess it did kind of take me out a little bit because I kept thinking, well, that's a weird thing to do, dramatically speaking. I don't know if that's if that was Martin Landau's idea or if the director inspired that one, if that was part of the blocking when they were getting ready to shoot the episode. I have no idea. But it was the one weird moment for me.
Yeah, I mean, if you start thinking about the camera angles and stuff, it's never gonna hold up because it's
no. And many times they have to, and we've seen this sort of thing actually in Star Trek, even when they're using the tri-screen communicator. Mm-hmm. How you have to have your person in the room stand off at an angle so that the camera can get a straight-on view of the person on the bridge or sick bay or wherever they're communicating to in order to make that scene work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that they do a lot of that in Space 1999 where, if memory serves, where if they're talking to somebody and it's on the big screen or the moderate-sized screen in the wall, that our person in the room has to stand off at an angle because otherwise how can the camera get a view of the person that they're talking to?
Right.
So it's one of these really weird television literary type licenses, I suppose. It does not technically make sense, but you need to do it just so that the scene will play.
Yeah, yep. All righty then. I guess we are ready for the next episode to discuss because we are done breaking away from the Earth here.
Yeah.
So next episode, I'm sure they're going to be visiting the planet Meta. And,
yeah, I think.
You would think that. You would think that.
Because it looks like Meta's heading towards them, and they're heading towards Meta, so it would make sense.
And on top of that, of course, the fact that the moon can't possibly be moving, but a fraction of the speed of light, so there's only so many places that they're ever going to be able to get to in their lifetime, like the Oort cloud, perhaps.
But I seem to remember
may have been counting more planets than that.
Well, I also seem to remember that they come up with a – and I hate to say this right now because we really gave this episode largely very glowing remarks. But I seem to remember that in the future that there are certain scientific loopholes. Yes, there's a lot of plutonium that allows them to get from one part of the galaxy to another.
Yeah.
I just want to wrap up my thoughts with I thought Brian Johnson's model work was superb. I forgot it was Brian Johnson because when I started watching, I thought it was Derek Meddings, and I'm glad you reminded me that it was Brian Johnson.
Yeah,
I'd forgotten
Meddings
that
was UFO. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Brian Johnson's model work in this is just stellar, from the moon base to the ships to the satellite. It was really wonderful to look at. It felt very old school having this level of detail on all the model work, especially by today's standards.
Do you know what's funny about it? I mean, I have never had a criticism of it. Well, that's not true. There are occasionally you can see a star pass through an eagle or something because they didn't because they use truly old school model effect work. It's not even blue screen. They are shooting a section of the screen and blacking out part of it, and then they are cranking the film back and then blacking out the camera and then shooting another segment of it. Is how they achieve
it's a sort of a matte process, I think.
Well, yeah, basically by blocking out part of the film or blocking out part of the picture, you are not exposing that film.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they run it back, now it's almost a double exposure, except that half of it's been blocked off.
Right.
So then you can get footage in the other half. And so they do occasionally have spots where they run one mat over the other, and then you get some stuff. So, but that's very rare, and it's not really a problem. The one thing that I thought was that I did notice in this episode that I had never noticed before, and it was truly a minor thing. What I did not know when I watched Space 1999 the first time is that the mountains in the back of Moonbase are cardboard printed out pictures. They are not three-dimensional in any way, shape, or form. They are just diorama pictures that are placed behind the moon base model. And they look fantastic. But when the moon starts to pull away and they drop, actually raising the camera,
yeah. You
can see the three planes of three sets of mountains.
Oh, no. I need to watch it again.
Just for a second. And that's the first and only time I ever noticed that on the show. It's like
I've never seen that, so I have to watch it again now just for that one bit.
It's right towards when the moon starts moving out of the Earth's orbit.
Yeah, I know the scene you're talking about. I'll have to take another look at that.
But it's really not a problem. It just was like, oh yeah, that's the one spot where you can tell that they are in fact cardboard mountains.
Yeah, bummer.
Back there. But it doesn't detract from the show.
Yeah. No, I would.
I would hate for them to go back and do digital effects.
Digitally fix it? Oh no, no, leave it alone.
Well, no, even you know, like they did Star Trek, where they were just replaced all the special effects shots.
Oh, don't do that.
It does not. No. The show does not need that.
No, it doesn't need it. No, because the visuals so far are just absolutely superb. Now, I thought this was an outstanding first episode. In fact, I probably go on record saying this is probably one of the best science fiction pilot episodes I've ever seen. Seriously, it's that brilliantly well done. And I would even apply the word epic.
Fair enough. I know I was excited for more when it went after the first episode aired.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, Ben, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fusionpatrol. Our Twitter username is @fusionpatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at youtube.com/fusionpatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.